This is the white liberal argument that characterizes much of our reading culture. That there is a fundamental binary between political art and the real art that transcends such dogma, such instruction, such moralizing. The panic here is that art, true art, our tragic and ever far Dulcinea, may be under siege from the contaminating force of the polity and its concerns. That indeed we risk losing all art, throw it straight into the garbage bin, if we ever dare to ask art to be more than it is, to do more than what it ought to do. The problem is, this panic defensiveness rarely seems to actually know what it wants the art to be, what it wants art to do. This paranoid testudo formation rarely seems to have a handle on what reading, and in particular critical reading, actually consists of. Sure, critical reading is an intellectual exercise, an aesthetic exercise, and a profoundly private, emotional, and visceral undertaking, while also being an ethical act, a civic act. It is all these things at once. Books ask us to live this multiplicity every single time we open them. But there's often a conservative, reactionary resistance to the expansive multiplicity, and specifically inclusivity, of critical reading, which encompasses postcolonial readings, queer readings, what's sometimes pejoratively called anachronistic readings. The argument usually goes something along the lines of, we can't apply contemporary political worldviews onto older texts because, quote, the world was different then. Sure, it was. But it also wasn't, is the thing. The lives of the characters in Jane Austen's novels will always be entwined with Britain's empire and slave economy. That was always the case. Slavery and the capitalist extraction of resources from Caribbean colonies were banal and foundational facts of life in Austen's era, and that ubiquity does not erase the world-rending evil those practices represented, nor does it invalidate the minutely drawn humanity of the specific parts of her world Austen was able to recognize and bring to life. Although, as Montclair State University professor and scholar of British abolitionist literature Patricia Matthews has deftly pointed out, both in her Atlantic article on teaching but not loving Jane Austen and her webinar, I Hope White Hands, Wedgwood, Abolition, and the Female Consumer, the canonization of Austen, quote, whose fiction played with, but ultimately conformed to, the social conventions of her time, throws into relief the fact that many of Austen's less passionately remembered contemporaries did, in fact, write about race and interracial marriages, quote, that were not tucked away in Charlotte Bronte's attic. Rejecting contemporary discussions of race when it comes to Austen's work also masks the fact that political debates about abolition among wealthy, educated whites, especially the white women who were both Austen's subject and audience, were by no means exceptional. Austen's, not to mention Elizabeth Bennet's, contemporaries were known to have, quote, circulated petitions, raised funds for the cause, and boycotted sugar from the West Indies. Even Wedgwood, famed purveyor of teacups to many a well-heeled character from Austen to Bridgerton, as well as any self-respecting cottagecore picnic bitch influencer, produced teapots and cameo medallions and sugar bowls decorated with abolitionist artwork and slogans due to founder Josiah Wedgwood's membership in the Society for the Abolition of the Slave Trade. While, of course, also producing tea services that celebrated Britain's naval might and seafaring heroes, demurely declining to elaborate just to what purpose and laden with what cargo those great ships, immortalized in bone china and creamware, once sailed. In fine-combing the political nuances and limitations of the era's gendered economies, Matthews draws our attention to a dynamic that echoes Toni Morrison's diagnosis of the way white selfhood was necessarily illuminated by casting blackness as its shadow. The Regency construction of white womanhood, the deliberate signals sent by its purchasing tastes, the nobility of its humanitarian and proto-feminist endeavors, necessitated, literally served up, a subaltern black object for the liberal white woman to save, consume, and ultimately absorb into the drama of her own political enlightenment. TLDR, a contemporary Austen character, would wear that Dior feminist Logan t-shirt. Thus, The complicated political substance of an abolitionist teapot cannot be divorced from its time period.